Okay, so lots more people come to actual talks than to organizational meetings. That's the first lesson. So today I'm going to try to give some kind of introduction to these wall crossing formulas. And then the plan is that Richard, who's not here but supposed to be here, next week is supposed to tell us some things that he learned about such formulas at a conference that he was at, which prevented him from coming to the organizational meeting last week. And in particular, he heard talks by two of the three authors of the wall crossing formula paper that I've kind of started my thinking along the lines of that we should do the seminar. And Greg Moore, the third author, had given a talk at KITP here in the summer. So, you know, people in attendance will have heard talks from all of the relevant people. And then the week after that, Andreas will talk about some more details of the Zybrick-Witten story that I will briefly allude to today, as well as some other work he's been doing, which is also related somehow to all these wall-crossing formula issues. And then the week after that, we need a speaker. So I will be bothering some of you about who should be the speaker the week after that. Okay, so this is a mixed audience, and it's always supposed to be a mixed audience in this seminar. So I want to make a little dictionary between some things in geometry and some things in physics, which is what gets this whole wall-crossing business started. So in physics, there are various ways to achieve a four-dimensional n equal 2 supergravity theory. So maybe one of the best way we know of doing that is to start with a string theory in 10 or 11 dimensions and compactify that string theory on an appropriate manifold of dimension 6 or 7, leaving you with four dimensions left over. And the geometric properties of that manifold determine how much of the large amount of supersymmetry in the gravity theory in the higher-dimensional space survives to the four-dimensional space. So that's how you form effective theories of four-dimensional supergravity. So typically this will be something like type 2A or 2B string theory compactified on a Calabi-Yau threefold. That's a typical way of arriving at such a thing. And there's a closely related set of theories, which are the four-dimensional n equal 2 supersymmetric theories with no gravity. Again, there are various ways of constructing those with directly from field theory, but one can also think about these as type 2A or 2B on certain non-compact Calabi-Yaus. So I should have stressed that this was a compact Calabi-Yau threefold. And there are various ways of reading off what's supposed to be the field theory content of the partially compactified. I mean, the word compactify is a little strange because it's not compact, right? And the fact that it's not compact means that you have to separate, you have to pay attention to what are the normalizable modes in the Calabi-Yau direction to understand what kind of truncation you want to make to get a four-dimensional supersymmetric theory. Anyway, those are sort of technical issues with respect to the physics. It's the fact that there are these Calabi-Yau manifolds in there that gives us some kind of dictionary between some things happening in physics and some things happening in geometry. Now, in either of these two kinds of theories, so what does it mean to have an n equal 2 supersymmetry or supergravity theory? It means that there is some super Lie algebra, which contains the Poincaré algebra, the usual symmetry algebra of relativistic classical theories. There's some superalgebra which contains the Poincaré algebra, and it has a name. These are two different slight variants of the superalgebra that we want. And that superalgebra has its physical particle content determined by its representation theory. So one wants to study representations of these superalgebras. So take representations of the superalgebras. And among, right, so I'm not sure whether everybody in the room is familiar with looking at the action of Poincaré on the cones of constant space-time momentum and the interpretation of that as a mass in the physical theory. But anyway, in these representations of the superalgebra, there are, of these n equal 2 superalgebras, there are some particularly nice ones called BPS massive representations. And they have the interesting property that if you have an arbitrary representation, it has a mass which is greater than or equal to a particular quantity called the BPS charge. And this inequality is saturated for these BPS representations. So, well, if you don't know what I just said, then you didn't learn too much except for you heard some words. But if you did, then hopefully that reminded you of the relationship between mass and charge for these BPS states. Now, so one of the features of the supergravity or supersymmetric field theory is the possible set of these BPS states in the theory. And one can ask, so given a BPS charge, given a possible charge, I have to explain what that means, of a massive state, one can ask how many BPS states of that charge are there? So I just realized that I've used charge in two different ways in this sentence. So the BPS charge that we're talking about has to do with a certain central extension of the supersymmetry algebra. And on the other hand, these BPS objects are also charged under other gauge symmetry groups that appear in the problem. So the charges that I meant here, those are the charges under the gauge symmetry groups of the problem, and that's going to translate into things like cohomology classes of things on a manifold when we do the dictionary in just a minute. So given some kind of discrete data which labels the BPS states, you want to know how many BPS states of that charge are there. There might be an infinite number, there might be a finite number. Maybe if it's an infinite number, you'd like to do some kind of integral over the moduli space. Maybe you're counting the number of components of the moduli space, something of this sort. That's a typical question that one asks. And the answer to this question is called the spectrum of the theory, or the BPS spectrum of the theory, I should say. And it depends on the parameters of the n equal 2 theory. So one way of encoding this spectrum is to imagine summing over all possible quote charges. So you sum over all possible charges Q, and then you look at the number of BPS states. Maybe all possible charges E, some vector, and you look at the number of BPS states, and then you'd have some formal expression like Q to the E. So typically E is going to take values in some kind of lattice, and hopefully it's going to be a lattice intersected with a cone so that we have something that looks like a potentially convergent power series there. And expressions like this, these kind of generating functions for the BPS spectrum, those are the quantities that we're going to be most interested in this whole discussion. Well,
can I ask a question?
Yeah, sure.
Here in the, why compactifying in a non-compact Calabi-Yau gets rid of the gravity dynamics?
It doesn't necessarily. So I was sort of giving an example. But if you're in a situation in which, for example, the compact part of the Calabi-Yau, you sort of look at all the compact subvarieties that it has, if those could all be shrunk to a point, then that process of shrinking to a point decouples the gravity and leaves you with a field theory. So there are ways of taking a field theory construction and getting it from Calabi-Yau manifolds, and those ways turn out to be related to the geometry, which is the only reason that I'm mentioning them. So in the geometry, this basic notion, well, let's see. So in the geometry, this basic notion of the mass being greater than or equal to something called the BPS charge, which depends somehow on the parameters of the theory, translates into the following general geometric property. So I have my Calabi-Yau threefold X, and I have some kind of homology class. Let me call it gamma for a minute. Let's just think of it as a homology class on X, probably compactly supported, something like that. And in a given homology class, I can look for, ask when are there some kind of mass volume minimizing cycles in the class gamma. Well, that stated in that generality, it's a hard problem, doesn't have a general solution, but there's a very nice situation in which you get a natural class of volume minimizing cycles, natural set of volume minimizing cycles in a particular cohomology class, and that's when there's what's called in the mathematics literature a calibration on X. And a calibration on X is a particular kind of differential form. So this would be some omega living in the cohomology of X. Well, I should write it as a differential form. It's a differential form on X because it's more than just its cohomology class. Typically, you want it to be closed. And there's a sort of natural condition that you can write down in differential geometry, which makes such a which makes such a thing locally volume minimizing. So fundamental property that a calibration is supposed to have is that when you integrate omega over y with y in the class gamma, then that's I'm saying something wrong here.
Less than or equal.
Pardon?
Less than or equal.
Well, I know, but I had greater than or equal to. What am I doing wrong?
The integral over y of omega is less than or equal to the volume of y.
Yes, thank you. It's less than or equal to the volume of y. So the volume of y, appropriately interpreted, corresponds to the mass of some particle in the effective theory, which is given by what's known as a D-brain in the type 2 theory, wrapping the cycle y. And this integral gets interpreted as the BPS charge of the corresponding cycle. So this mass greater than or equal to BPS charge has this translation into properties of a particular kind of geometric structure that might occur on the manifold X called a calibration. Now, calibrations were studied by Harvey and Lawson. That's Reese Harvey, the mathematician, not Jeff Harvey, the string theorist. I used to be able to quote the date of this paper, but it's 1980, roughly? Anybody know? Do you know, Shinta? Anyway, these calibrations were studied by Harvey and Lawson, and it might even be earlier than that. One found a number of different kinds of calibrations. So the prototype of this is when omega is a Kähler form of a Kähler metric, or powers of a Kähler form of a Kähler metric. So the Kähler form itself would calibrate surfaces, Riemann surfaces, sitting inside of X. The minimum is achieved if the surface is actually a complex submanifold of the complex manifold. And similarly, if you take powers of the Kähler form, not Kähler metric. If you take powers of the Kähler form, you end up finding the minimal volume subvarieties being, again, complex submanifolds of the Kähler manifold of appropriate dimensions. Their classification also included capital omega, which is a holomorphic n-form, non-vanishing, on a Calabi-Yau n-fold. So that's another natural class of calibrations. Also includes a complex symplectic form, which is a holomorphic two-form on a complex symplectic manifold, so-called hyper-Kähler manifold of an appropriate dimension. And then there were a couple of exceptional cases having to do with manifolds whose holonomy was spin 7 or G2. In fact, one of the fundamental results of Harvey and Lawson is that for there to exist a calibration, if there exists a calibration on the manifold, then the holonomy of the Riemannian metric on the manifold is restricted in some way by the existence of that calibration, either to the Kähler class, which is a restriction from SO2N to UN, the unitary group, or to some of the more particular classes having to do with Ricci flat structures that are available for Calabi-Yau manifolds, for hyper-Kähler manifolds, and for the G2 and spin 7 cases. I don't really know why there's not a quaternion Kähler calibration. I don't think there is, but that's the sort of missing thing in the dictionary of holonomies in terms of this kind of structure. Okay, a very simple case of this, two simple cases of this will be if we want to study three cycles on the Calabi-Yau, which are calibrated by the holomorphic three form, and they have a special name. They're called special Lagrangian three cycles. I point out that to follow my idea of wrapping a D-brain, if I want to do the physical application, on this cycle and getting a particle in the effective theory, then what I want to wrap is a D3 brain. This should be wrapped. And so this is relevant for the type 2B string theory. Or I can talk about 2K cycles on a Calabi-Yau, cycles of dimension 2k, and those are supposed to be calibrated by the kth power of the Kähler form, and those are known as complex submanifolds. And if I'm in the compact Calabi-Yau case, where compact Calabi-Yau manifolds of complex dimension at least 3 are known to be projective varieties. So you can put them in projective space and conclude that any right, these cycles are supposed to be in the homology with compact support or something like that. So I'm interested in compact complex submanifolds. Those actually are also projective things themselves. They can be defined by algebraic equations, and there's a lot of good technology for studying these things from algebraic geometry.
So do you need to consider vanishing background from Ramon fields or something?
Yes.
Because otherwise the action of the brain is not the volume of the brain.
That's right. That's right. That's right. There should be no Ramon fluxes. I don't actually...
No, otherwise it's generalized calibration or something?
generalized calibration, and I mean, I don't really have Calabi-Yau anymore because I've got Ramon background in my, so I've got some modification of the Calabi-Yau condition. And yes, these things have been studied in various guises in recent years, but I'm not going to talk about them. So here, I want to point out that there is no technology available. In other words, if it's my job to tell you all about the special Lagrangian 3 cycles on a Calabi-Yau manifold, well, if I'm lucky, I can find a few. There's one construction that's known for building special Lagrangian 3 cycles, but even that construction is not preserved under small deformations, and you know, and it only finds a very small class of the special Lagrangian 3 cycles. So because here I want to wrap a D2K brain, the relevant theory is the type 2A theory. And, well, there's this phenomenon of mirror symmetry, which is supposed to relate the physics on the type 2A string theory compactified on one particular Calabi-Yau to the type 2B string theory compactified on the mirror Calabi-Yau. And if that's true, then you would expect to be able to detect this kind of massive spectrum either on this side or on this side. So if you kind of accept mirror symmetry as telling you all of the answers to this problem via this problem, then it would be fine to just study this problem. And since this is the only one we can study, that's good.
So
I agree that here we have good technology for calculating the BPS charge, and here we have good technology for calculating the spectrum. So I agree that you have to mix the two. But the way that the two are normally mixed is as follows. You take the information that you take from the mirror is what is the moduli space, which tells you how to calculate the BPS charge there, and then you use that information, you compare it with specific facts that you learn about complex submanifolds or their generalizations from the derived category, but never mind for people who don't know about that. So yeah, I'm sorry, so it's kind of a mixture of techniques. But in terms of studying the cycles themselves, we don't have any technology for doing it on this side. Okay. So Seiberg and Witten ran into a version of this BPS counting business when they were studying n equal to supersymmetric quantum field theory. And, you know, the first case they did was gauge group SU2 and no matter. And, of course, it got vastly generalized later on. The same phenomenon happened. But let me just kind of summarize some stuff which they learned in their original paper about this. So, as I've been alluding to, there are some parameters. The parameters are in these geometric cases are quite geometric. They have to do with the choice of Calabi-Yau metric on the compactifying space, and that choice of Calabi-Yau metric separates into a choice of Kähler form, Kähler class, together with a choice of complex structure. And in the type 2 theories, that has to be supplemented by what's known in physics as the B field. That's an additional 2 form with taking values in R mod Z, effectively, which has to be supplemented to give all the data that we need to specify those BPS charge formulas that I mentioned. On the other hand, in this case, there's some complex parameter U, which is it's the single parameter in the theory. And Seiberg and Witten wanted to compare the weakly coupled version of this theory. So the weakly coupled can be studied using basically perturbative techniques in quantum field theory. And they found ways of extending their understanding to the strongly coupled region. where you didn't have access to perturbative techniques. And one of the key ingredients of this was the realization that the BPS charge formula. So for the first time, I'm writing the Z without brackets. So this is something like a complexified BPS charge. The part of it which actually occurs in the mass formula, it really is the absolute value, but there's a more refined invariant of the physical theory, which is complex valued. So this BPS charge really is a function of the parameter U. And as a function of the parameter U, it's holomorphic. Now, I should say that we should take out minus bad values. So the there are some parameter values at which the standard description of this physical theory as the SU2 gauge theory with no matter, n equal to SU2 gauge theory with no matter, is not an adequate description. So we should remove some bad values. But aside from removing the bad values, this is a holomorphic function. Turns out there are two bad values that we have to worry about, so there are going to be 2 points where we have to worry about something happening. But away from those 2 points, it's a holomorphic function. Now, because I've got 2 points to remove, it might not be single valued. So one of the indications that these bad points really exist is that any attempt to write down this Z of U as a single valued function fails. Turns out to be a multiple valued function, but it's something that can be described pretty easily once you've deleted the appropriate points from the complex plane. So the Z of U itself is holomorphic, and the Z is determining the mass formula, and then you can sort of ask the question about the BPS spectrum, which states in the physical theory exist, and maybe how many of them there are, but in this case there's either one or zero for each possible value of the SU2 charges in question. The charges in question, let me say it that way. I shouldn't have said SU2. And what happens is that, one's first guess is that the spectrum of charges is completely invariant under this space. It should be invariant under any of the monodromy, which happens as you go around here, because this will somehow change under monodromy. But if you had a spectrum that was completely invariant, you'd be able to completely determine everything. Everything would be great. And that just turns out to be false. So one can use the perturbative techniques to calculate the spectrum at large U. So the spectrum can be calculated at large U. And, well, let's see. So there are two integers, electric and magnetic charge numbers. And the non-zero, so maybe this moduli space is non-empty, if and only if NE and M is 0 plus or minus 1, or plus or minus 1, comma, K. Moreover, the monodromy in question, the monodromy that acts on these vectors, N, E, and M, is a group known as gamma 2, the two congruent subgroup sitting inside of SL2Z. Well, I don't have the time or the inclination to try to explain how Zeiberg and Witten arrived at these results in their study at that time. Maybe Andreas will tell us some of that stuff in a couple of weeks. But these were the two facts, and this is visibly not invariant under SL2Z. So there was a puzzle, and the puzzle is resolved by realizing what happens in this particular case. So you have these two particular points where something strange happens, and it happens that the absolute value of z is the same at those two points, and one can imagine plotting the curve. So absolute value of z is some very explicit formula that Zeiberg and Witten found as a function of u, which is appropriately invariant at a gamma of 2. So it's a multiple value thing, has the right gamma of 2 transformation properties, and you can look at the place where this takes the value. So it's the same value as the singular points. And in fact, what's happening there...
Sorry, can you say again what you're plotting there?
I'm plotting some z equals constant.
The line of all.
Yes.
Thickening and then I'm on
That's possible. I remembered the.
I think it's a magnetic.
N M N E. Yeah, yeah. It says right there. N M N E. Thank you. Or I could have said that E stands for magnetic and M stands for electric. See, one thing we're taught as mathematicians is not to have a variable hang up. I mean, to define everything carefully, and then it doesn't matter what you called it. But never mind. So what I'm describing there is absolute z equal constant. Well, I'm kind of messing this up, I have to admit. Because I think what I really want, what I'm really describing in the terms that Zeiberg and Witten use is the imaginary part of the ratio AD over A. There's some exponential someplace, some factor of I that's missing in this discussion. Vanishing. That's what I'm really describing there.
What was A again?
Well, I didn't tell you. But if you know about Zeiberg-Witten and the Zeiberg-Witten solution, they introduce two quantities, A and A sub D, and they calculate everything in terms of differential equations satisfied by those guys, and the ratio being real was supposed to correspond to the BPS mass formula.
So let's just say Z is real, right?
I guess it says Z is real. So I guess writing it in terms of norm z hasn't quite been right because there's some exponential someplace that I'm doing wrong. In fact, at the two bad points, the reason that they're bad is that the some BPS state becomes massless. Now, there's a big difference in the physical theory between massive objects and massless objects. Massive objects have some fixed size, which is determined by the mass, and because of that fixed scale associated to the massive object, you can do a very good approximation of the theory, which will work at appropriate scales in which you don't quite ignore the massive objects, but you account for their effects in a fairly static way. So normally physics is a dynamical thing where you're kind of considering all the possible states of the physical system, and there's a sort of standard way, which is called integrating out the massive modes, of treating the massive things as if they didn't fluctuate, as if they were these big, heavy things, so much larger than the scale that you're working at, that they're affecting your physics negligibly, and rewriting everything in terms of massless, what's called massless degrees of freedom alone. That trick doesn't work if you had something which you thought was going to be massive, but it turned out at some particular parameter value to be massless. And in fact, there are lots of indications that the physical theory that's written down as this SU2 gauge theory without matter, when tuned to those parameters, has a lot of problems. And the essential explanation for the problems is that there was an additional massless degree of freedom which you ignored when you were writing down the theory, and that you really should have formulated the theory including that additional massless point, massless state. So at these two particular parameter values, there are extra massless states which weren't present generically. And in fact, there's a mechanism which allows the state to gain mass when you move the parameter value away from that particular point. So you could have different sets of massless states at one point or another point. And that the basic realization which Seiberg and Witten came to was that the spectrum of massive particles can change if you cross the value of the BPS mass, which was the same as that of the singular point, and that there can be some kind of decays of what used to be valid fundamental particles in the spectrum into what are known as bound states, which would then sort of decay into their constituent quantities when you cross the wall. So,
so the properties at that point somehow control the properties of the wall far from the point as well?
What's controlled far from the wall is a decay process. So whether there can be a decay process is controlled by whether you're at the wall or not. So the question is this particular value of the charges, which maybe you could write that as the sum of two other vectors, would a particle with those charges necessarily decay into those other vectors? Well, on this side of the wall, the other vectors have a larger mass, which means that the decay won't happen. But on this side of the wall, one of them has a smaller mass, which means that decay will happen. Right? So the extreme form of it is when you're right at this point, something actually becomes massless. But even here, the decay products can change. So that's the basic physical thing that happens, and these are called, this is called the phenomenon of the BPS spectrum jumping. And a boundary like this is called, really should be called a jumping wall. It's often called a jumping line. Because of this first example where it was just a line in the complex plane. But in general, we're going to have a complex parameter space of some larger dimension, and this jumping phenomenon happens in real codimension 1 for that parameter space. Okay.
The same thing as marginal stability.
Marginal stability. Well, it's a wall of marginal stability. So the marginal stability refers to the phenomenon that I just illustrated in response to Joe's question, namely, when you're right at this point, if you examine the BPS charges to decide whether it's this one or this one that you should get, you get no decision. Either one is equally likely. On one side of the wall, you get one kind of state. On the other side of the wall, you get the other state.
Can I just back up?
Sure.
Can you give some intuition why do you have these charges in the preservative
thing? Let's see. These are the electric charges, and then there are some dions. And you, so why are there dions in the spectrum? It's you see them for reasons of supersymmetry, if I recall correctly. You analyze the n equal 2 multiplets, and you see that these bound states ought to exist. Anybody remember the argument off the top of their head? I don't remember.
Well, the electric ones are easy to see. They're part of the perturbative spectrum. That's the W plus the W minus.
Right.
The magnetic monopoles, you have to argue that they are BPS objects. But then it turns out that the there's an extra coordinate that parameterizes the magnetic degrees of freedom in the magnetic monopoles. And when you're quantizing that coordinate, you end up, that coordinate is in some sense carrying charge. So the claim is that when you quantize that coordinate, that's why you get the k over there, which is the different possible wave functions of that extra coordinate.
Right.
And there's usually this shift that can happen on the electric charge.
Can you also have two different descriptions, one electric description, magnetic description, which many models, when you can consider a combination of them, right?
In the original Sauber-Witten stuff that I remember, the duality assumption was put in by hand, and there was no reason to believe that it was a magnetic description beforehand. They just said
That's right. It was an electric description at large U, and one tried to find what were the possible BPS states. It was conceivable that you would have electrically or magnetically charged objects, but it was the electric states which were the fundamental degrees of freedom in the assumption. And then they found this dual description valid at small u, which has a completely different kind of spectrum. So a lot of the states change quite a bit, but the essential point is that when you encircle this point, then you find that there was a shifting. I mean, some states went away and some other ones came back, but there was a shifting in numbers as it happened. And that shifting in numbers exactly compensates for, well, I didn't write down to you which generator of SL2Z you had going around that point, but it's something like minus 1-2-1 or something like that in some normalization. So you had to have a shift of the charges for it all to work.
That's the same monotony matrix.
I don't know. That's a monodromy matrix. That's right. Depends on whether these are rows or columns. I don't know what normalization I want, which is why I wasn't going to write it down.
So now can you tell better which particle can decay into two in this wall, which is these particles that you said that were the basic...
Let's see. So it's So if I follow in from here, it's some of these dionic states, maybe all of these dionic states, which become massless here. And that means that they're, even here, if they're not massless, they decay into maybe some, I don't remember, but they decay into some, you know, simple one plus some number of these guys or something like that.
So it was like this lattice with the charges, right?
And right.
So if the particles are collinear in the lattice, then they can decay, right? And the collinearity of the particle depends on how the axis of the lattice are.
That's right.
The angle between them, right? So this wall of marginal stability is some value in which such that they tilt and they make particles.
Right. Right. This function z should be thought of as a function on that a complex function in that plane, right? And so it's when the values have been tuned so that this matches up with one of these as a multiple. So in the geometric context, the analog of this U-plane becomes the parameter, which is the complexified Kähler class of the Calabi-Yau. So I mentioned that you introduced this additional two-form called B, the B field, which is in the physical theory. And traditionally, mathematicians, algebraic geometers, would have only studied the Kähler class itself and would not have paid attention to an imaginary part. And, of course, if you restrict the phenomenon that I'm just talking about to some real line, well, this kind of jumping behavior will sort of be exhibited again in real codimension 1 on that line. And if one learns how to incorporate appropriately the B field into the geometry, one will still see this jumping phenomenon happen with values of the B field. Let me contrast this to some other piece of work that I was involved in 15 years ago, in which other quantities having to do with the conformal field theory that depended on this complexified Kähler class turned out only to have a singularity at one particular point that didn't extend along a line. And then by taking an appropriate kind of meromorphic function on some complex variable, you were able to do an analytic continuation around there by using the B field. That doesn't work in this context. This is a context where the kind of jumping phenomenon that we're going to see in geometry in just a minute really does persist even if we add the B field. It's that wall of marginal stability phenomenon that's governing the thing. So what kind of things are there in the geometry of Calabi-Yau's which end up reproducing this sort of behavior of spectrum jumping, but in some controlled way, when you cross these lines of marginal stability? Well, there's this really happy accident of history, which is that the word stable got used both for what the BPS states would be, I mean, here it's natural to call it stable, and in algebraic geometry independently, and they mean the same things. So this is the phenomenon of stability in moduli problems in algebraic geometry. So I'll spend maybe 10 minutes telling you about something that looks completely unrelated, and then I'll spend 5 minutes telling you why it is related, I hope. Yeah, those time estimates could stretch a little bit. So, how do you want to construct a moduli space, a parameter space in algebraic geometry? Well, typically, you have some collection of objects. So, we have some algebra-geometric objects which are labeled by complex numbers. But then we have some symmetries of the problem. And the typical kind of symmetry group is a complex symmetry group. So an example of such a thing might be that we had two complex numbers which were labeling our objects. So this could be like coefficients in an equation someplace. And then we might have a symmetry group of C star acting on those complex numbers. So you might have Z1 and Z2 being identified with lambda Z1 and lambda Z2. And what you'd like to do is form a quotient space. Actually, by even writing it that way, I indicate that we want to form a quotient space. But this problem, as stated, has a real difficult time with the quotient. And the problem is that 0, 0 lies in the closure of every orbit. Sorry. Yeah. So what are the orbits? The orbits of this look like essentially lines through the origin, right? Well, except for the origin itself. So punctured lines through the origin. And every punctured line through the origin has the origin in its closure. So what I would kind of like to do is associate a point to every line through the origin, but I'd like the topology of the quotient space to reflect the topology of the space, the original space. And if it does, I'm in deep trouble because every orbit here has this particular point in its closure. I can't put a Hausdorff topology on the quotient space which is compatible with the topologies that I started out with. Hausdorff means that you've given two points, you can find an open set containing one and not containing the other, and that's problematic in this story. So the kind of naive or practical way of doing this is to take the set of Z1, Z2s, but just exclude 0, 0, and then we can mod out by C star no problem, and we get a very familiar complex algebraic variety, CP1. So the step where you leave out the origin before modding out by C star in order to form CP1 is a prototype of the issues that arise in constructing moduli spaces in algebraic geometry. So Mumford considered this problem in the early 60s in a massive book called Geometric Invariant Theory, which this problem, I have to say, had been considered in many respects, in the 19th century, quite extensively, without a really good formulation of what the geometric issues were. But when Mumford tackled it in the early 1960s, he came up with a way of identifying which things to leave out before taking a quotient if you wanted to get a good quotient. And the first case he considered was, well, sorry, this is probably not historically true, but the first case I will consider is vector bundles on a Riemann surface. So if I consider vector bundles on a Riemann surface, it turns out that the bad ones, the ones that are contained in the closure of every orbit, are vector bundles V, which have sub-bundles W, with the property that the degree of W divided by the rank of W is bigger than the degree of V divided by the rank of V. So this is bad if. So, well, let's see. How are we going to describe vector bundles on Riemann surfaces? Well, that'll be some matrices having to do with the transition functions. And when I look at those matrices, having the degree over the rank big sort of suggests that I've got the ability to I can't do this. So the first version was a pure linear algebra version, and has to do with, you know, which orbits in the space of group elements mod conjugation are enclosures of which other orbits. But I can't sort of quickly translate that into this condition. Let me just say bad. And actually, he used the term unstable to denote this in that case. Okay, so that was one of the main examples that he worked out in detail in his book. And in subsequent years, it took probably 15 years for people to sort it out, people tried various versions of extending this to higher dimensions. And the one that was eventually shown to have the right kind of properties is known as Mumford-Takamoto stability. So again, this is the problem of moduli of vector bundles on a fixed algebraic variety. And I choose this example because it's been studied in a lot of detail, but the problems of how many curves of a particular kind on a Calabi-Yau manifold, which are the ones that are relevant over there, those qualitatively have this same kind of behavior that I'm illustrating in this other case. With Mumford-Takamoto stability, you looked at sub-bundles again, but for each subbundle, you defined, so X is now a projective algebraic variety. That just means it can be put into some projective space, and H is an ample divisor on this variety. So the stability in question depends on H, and it is the first term class of the bundle intersected with h to the d minus 1, d is the dimension of the variety, divided by the rank of the bundle. So for curves, there was no entering of this ample divisor h, but once you got beyond curves, you really couldn't make sense of this kind of stability notion unless you introduced this auxiliary thing of an ample divisor. And then the condition is the same. So actually, let me formulate the condition for stable. Stable says that for every W in V with rank W less than rank V, we have that the degree over rank, the generalization of degree over rank of W is strictly less than degree over rank of V. And then there's a related notion called semi-stable, which is the same thing but with less than or equal to instead of less than. So Mumford showed that semi-stable objects could form a moduli space. That moduli space was a little bit funny at the semi-stable locus, but it contains, typically this one is compact, if you're lucky, and then it typically contains the stable objects as an open subset, and sometimes the stable set is equal to the semi-stable set. Well, there's a dependence on H here. So we had to think of the moduli spaces depending on H. And where does H take its values? It takes values in the naturally in the Kähler cone of the variety. So H2 of X contains the Kähler cone of X. And you can think of the first Chern class, you can think of the class of H as defining an element in that Kähler cone. And so we're in this situation where as you take different values, now admittedly this has to be a rational element in the Kähler cone, but there's nothing which stops you from making the same definition using not just H but any but the Kähler class for some Kähler metric. So ample divisor would be fine, but I could also use omega to the d minus 1. These would no longer be rational numbers as they are now, but that you could still make a definition. And to the best of my knowledge, the first person to systematically study the behavior of these moduli spaces as you varied H was Michael Thaddeus around 1990. And he studied, he discovered that the structure of this space as an algebraic variety was constant throughout various cones within the Kähler cone, but could change as you cross from one cone to another. And that typically, in the interior of the cone, the semi-stable locus was equal to the stable locus, and on the boundary, it became not equal, and then it switched over to some other kind of guy in the next cone over. So this is the same BPS jumping phenomenon in algebraic geometry, where if we're looking at certain kinds of moduli problems, the moduli spaces will actually be points, and the jumping phenomena will be going from one to another, changing the number of actual points. Or possibly we're going to count connected components, something of that sort. These BPS jumping problems will be of exactly this kind. And the complexified Kähler cone plays the same role in these compactified string theories as the U parameter played in Zeiberg-Witten theory. So, in fact, we should expect exactly this kind of behavior of jumping of BPS classes, the BPS spectrum, from cone to cone. Okay, so anyway, the story that I just told, it has been understood for quite a while. People have been looking at these moduli spaces from this point of view, understanding lots of different things about the properties of stability conditions. In fact, this was formalized by Bridgeland around 2002, maybe. So he defined abstract stability conditions, and his definition of stability conditions was exactly motivated by the way that the BPS formula behaves and depends on parameters in this compactified string theory. So he made a version of the definition and showed that it reproduced all the phenomena that Thaddeus was looking at. This Mumford-Takamoto stability is kind of a special case of these abstract stability conditions. And these are the things which we're expecting to see exhibit the same kind of jumping behavior as one originally saw in Zeiberg-Witten theory. So what's the recent progress and excitement about? The recent progress and excitement has to do with a situation which I will illustrate by an example. Yeah, sure.
So basically, you told us that you cannot see this ample divisor in Zeiberg-Witten case because it would be only like a point, something like that.
Well, let's see. So this was a different problem, which was vector bundles on a Riemann surface.
Yeah, but I'm trying to understand that geometrically if you think of Zeiberg-Witten as this torus and...
So to relate...
Like you think of the U as, from the top parameter,
the
torus that you put in the
high. Right. So the way that I would model Zeiberg-Witten theory here is I would look for a non-compact Calabi-Yau manifold which had the geometry that would give me an SU2 gauge theory in the effective theory. And then that Calabi-Yau manifold, it would be non-compact, but there would be some Kähler parameters still associated with the compact part, and that Kähler parameter, which essentially would be measuring the size of some geometric object, would be identified with the U parameter in Seiberg-Witten. Now, the Kähler parameter itself is only sort of a real slice, so you need the B field in that same two-cycle direction to combine with the Kähler parameter to give the Seiberg-Witten U parameter. I can do that explicitly in a Calabi-Yau if you're.
What is H there again?
So H is essentially H would be, I mean, it wouldn't be an ample divisor in that case, but it would be some divisor. It would essentially be the Kähler class that I was just discussing, but restricted to only measuring the size that was relevant to the Seiberg-Witten problem, I mean, an ample divisor, I should mention, determines a Kähler class because it determines a way of embedding this algebraic variety into projective space. And then the standard metric on projective space, the so-called Fubini-Studi metric, restricts to a Kähler metric on the variety. So that was all in the compact case. In these non-compact cases, I only get to measure parts of the volumes by means of some Kähler class, but that's the Kähler class that would correspond to U. Okay, so what's all the recent excitement about? Well, I want to illustrate this with an example that was very recently worked out by Nagao and somebody. I'll come up with that name in just a second. I just blanked on it. Very embarrassing. Pardon? Thank you. I blanked on it. From?
I think you said that name.
Yeah, fine. That's good. So Nagao and Nakajima worked out a case of this where, again, we have some non-compact Calabi-Yau, and we have a non-compact Calabi-Yau in which the moduli problem can be very explicitly analyzed, and one can locate all of the lines of marginal stability for the corresponding moduli problem. And so I'm going to draw for you all the lines of marginal stability. The lines of marginal stability in this case, there are an countable number of them, and they accumulate towards this line y equals minus x from both sides. So there's the x and y axes, the line y equals minus x, and then, oops, that's not legal. And then some countable family of lines accumulating towards y equals x from either side. So there is a moduli problem. It can be described in both physics and algebraic geometry. We'll get to it in a few weeks. And it has an explicit solution. This is the form of that explicit solution. So we get a different BPS spectrum in each of these cases. And in particular, we get this odd situation of, you know, sort of an infinite number of BPS spectra that you have to consider before you ever get to this one. And the recent progress enables one. So this recent progress is unpublished and pretty much unavailable work of Konsevich and Soibelman. That's also extremely abstract, made much more concrete in a physical interpretation done by Giotto, Moore, and Nitsky. A way of completely analyzing and comparing those generating functions for BPS spectra in all of these regions. And so if we were limited to simple cases where, you know, you had only a finite number of walls and were crossing the walls, then we could easily imagine having used existing techniques to figure out what happens. But in fact, as was observed probably 10 years ago, well, maybe a little less, by Aspinwall and Douglas, one expects to find very complicated scenarios of lines of marginal stability, walls of marginal stability, and this new technique gives a way of analyzing them. So anyway, we have a fair amount of stuff to learn about in order to learn how this all works, both as a technique, also in the application to physics and the application to algebraic geometry, and that's what we'll be doing for weeks and weeks. I'll stop there for today.
So you're saying there that if we compactify on this non-compact Calabria, which is kind of, I guess, some weird variety, you'll get a four-dimensional gauge theory, which has this...
Yeah, so the non-compact Calabi-Yau, in fact, is a neighborhood of O minus 1 plus O minus 1, the guy who blows down to the conifold point. So this is various lines of marginal stability for that conifold point, and that conifold point has a field theory description in terms of a pair of UNs and some, you know, it's this quiver diagram, which everybody has seen, right, with the superpotential. And so that field theory is the field theory model for this guy, right? So there's going to be an explicit field theory description, and one will work out all of the possible regions of stability and all of the crossings and the formulas. Other questions? Okay. You won.